abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, March 18th, 2014. Don't have a lot of opening or closing banter for you guys over the next few days. We are still in recovery mode after the birth of the baby. And, of course, my wife has had a C-section and has quite a lot of recovery ahead of her. So all my energies and attention are focused on her, of course. But the program still goes on. And today we're welcoming Walter Block back to the program. You know Walter, because I wanted to talk about environmentalism. That's a topic a lot of people have been bringing up. How do we deal with environmentalism? Well, at some point I'll have Bob Murphy on to talk about the global warming issue. But today we're going to just talk about general environmental questions with Walter, who's written an awful lot. Walter holds the Harold E. Worth Eminent Scholar Chair at Loyola University, New Orleans. He's the author of numerous books, including Defending the Undefendable, his best-known book. He also has a book on the privatization of roads and highways, so he is pushing the boundaries of things, always. He's the author of over 400 refereed scholarly publications, and he's got a large chunk of those dedicated to the subject of the environment, which is why I thought of him. And finally, I suppose the last thing I'd say about Walter is that he inspires his students. He's actually co-authored scholarly articles with his students. As a student has a halfway decent paper, Walter says, look, I'll do some work on it, and you and I will get it published together. How many professors do you know who do that? So I'm very glad right now to welcome to the program Walter Block, whose website you can visit at walterblock.com. Walter, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure to be with you always.
I want to talk about the environment today. That's one of the areas that you specialize in. Now, when you have over 400 peer-reviewed articles, you specialize in a lot of things. But if you were to look through your CV, you'll find there's quite an extensive collection of writings on the subject of the environment. And I want to have you on because I feel like in some ways you really are, I don't want to say the only person doing this, because there are people who are doing so-called free market environmentalism, but you are the hardest core of the hardest core. And so that's why I find you especially interesting on these subjects. So let's start with the hardest issue of all, I think, in terms of the environment. I think people understand that property rights mean that the environment gets cared for better than if the government cares for it. Not the whole general public, but libertarians get that. Let's start with an area that even libertarians probably have some trouble with, and that would just be the general case of air pollution. And you're probably tired of talking about this, but I want to first talk about how Walter Block would handle air pollution, and then I'm going to introduce to you the so-called free market environmentalist idea of tradable pollution permits, and then you'll tell us what's wrong with that. But let's start off with, what's your ideal solution to the problem of air pollution?
Well, first I have to correct you. The hardest of the hardcore libertarian people on environmentalism is not me. It's Murray Rothbard. But
okay. All right, living.
I'm easier to get hold of than he is. Now.
Right.
So I will accept that great compliment. And my knowledge of environmentalism, I hate to say this, it also comes from Murray, as does a lot come from Murray. Murray had this magnificent article originally in the Cato Journal, and I reprinted it in a book of mine. It's called Air Pollution, or something like that. Oh, yeah, here it is, Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution. And in that article, Murray is just magnificent for a change.
Right.
You'll be shocked. The view is that air pollution is a trespass. Look, if I take my garbage eggshells, orange peels, coffee grounds, crap, whatever, and I just dump it on your front lawn. We all know how the law actually would work and should work. Namely, the men in the white suits would come and grab me, or maybe the men in the blue suits. Somebody would grab me and say, hey, look, you can't put your crap on Tom's lawn or on his property without his permission. What are you thinking? What are you, a maniac? However, if I grind this stuff up into little cinders and dust and stuff like that, and then I waft it over your house, well, we do have laws against that nowadays, too, although we didn't always, and I'd like to go into a little of the history of this. But the point is that there's no difference in principle between dumping, let's call it macro garbage on your property, and then micro garbage, which is all ground up into fine dust mites, so that you might not even be aware of it, except when you, if you put your laundry out there on a clothesline, as in the old days, you'll come back and it'll be a little dirty. Let me give the history again as I get it from Murray Rothbard. And what happened was in the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s in the U.S., law was pretty good. If a little old lady put out her laundry on a clothesline and she put it out there wet and clean, and she came back 2 hours later dry and dirty, and she went to court and said, hey, that there factory 2 miles away, you can see it's smokestacks of black smoke coming out of there, and it got onto my laundry. And I want two things. I want an injunction, and I want damages. An injunction is a ruling from the court saying, hey, factory, cut that out, otherwise we'll put you in jail. And then damages for the harm you've done to the little old lady. Or there was another case where a farmer would have haystacks on his property, and 300 feet away there'd be this railroad coming along, and it would have smoke and dust particles, and it would set sparks. It would set the man's haystacks on fire. Then the court would go, and the farmer would go to court and say, I want damages and an injunction. And pretty, not always, but pretty much the courts would uphold the plaintiff. These would be the environmentalists. You'd have to prove it. The burden of proof would be on you that it came from that railroad or that factory and not any other. But the courts were open to it, and often, not always, as in the real world, the plaintiff was upheld. Now, this had several very, very good effects. One, the factory was led, as if by Adam Smith's invisible hand, to use the slightly more expensive anthracite coal, which would be more expensive but very clean burning, rather than the sulfur coal, which was cheap but dirty burning. It would also give the factory owner an incentive to put something in his chimney, some sort of mesh to catch the smoke before it went out. Now look, you never had zero smoke. There is such a thing as a de minimis in law. The law does not concern itself with trifles. Look, we all breathe out. We all breathe dioxide.
Yeah.
I think, I'm not sure, carbon dioxide. So we're all polluters, but that sort of polluting doesn't count. It's de minimis. But there were several good effects, and we even had in the 1830s and 40s people with little microscopes trying to figure out, well, where did dust particle come from? And also, the railroad had an incentive to put smoke prevention devices or spark catchers on its railroad stock so that the sparks didn't go 300 feet. They only went 20 feet or whatever, or they were caught entirely. And, you know, things were pretty good. Perfect? No, not perfect. And there was even environmental forensics. Now, we all know what forensics is, you know, hair follicles and semen and blood and stuff to find out who the murderer and the rapist is. Well, in those days, you had the burgeoning environmental forensics movement or industry to try to figure out who done that, as we say in New Orleans, who done that. There was no problem. There was no crisis. There was no market failure. There was no nothing. Everything was sort of okay. And as technology would have improved, we would have found better ways had we followed this pattern. However, we then got into the Progressive Period. And in the Progressive Period, 1870, 1900, a new how shall I say, philosophy overtook the courts. And at that time, who was number one in the world? Great Britain. And who wanted to be number one in the United States? We wanted to kick butt. We wanted to be imperialist countries. So how do you become an imperialist country when a little old lady is bugging a manufacturing plant, or a stupid farmer is bugging a railroad? I mean, if you want to have battleships and tanks and stuff like that, you have to favor heavy industry. So the next time, well, I shouldn't say the next time, but the law changed slowly. And in the progressive period, when the environmental plaintiff came into court, the reaction was very different. The reaction was, yeah, they're violating your property rights. Yeah, of course. So who could doubt that? But your stinking, lousy private property rights are selfish and greedy. And there's something more important than that, and that is the public good. And what's the public good consist of? Pretty much manufacturing. Let me read a quote that I managed to pull out of Murray's article. And this is the case of Holman versus Athens Empire Laundry Company, 1919. The Supreme Court of Georgia declared, quote, "The pollution of the air, so far as is reasonably necessary to the enjoyment and, of life and indispensable to the progress of society, is not actionable." Unquote. Get that? Is not actionable? Well, if it's not actionable, and you're a green businessman or, say, a religious businessman, and you don't want to be polluting people, and you'll use the anthracite coal, even though it's a little more expensive, and you'll stick a mesh into your chimneys to catch pollution because you don't want to be a pain in the neck to other people, well, what's going to happen to you? The Adam Smith invisible hand is going to work in the exact opposite direction. I mean, it's going to penalize you because ceteris paribus, you now have a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis your competitors, and they'll drive you out of business. As a sop, the courts did say, okay, look, little old lady, we're not going to bug the manufacturing plant, but I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll have minimum smokestack height regulations. Now, before, the smokestacks were all 10, 20, 30 feet high, and now the smokestacks had to be 200 feet high. So, in effect, we pushed the problem not under the rug, but into the clouds. So the situation is just horrible from the progressive period. And then what happened, to continue the history to the more modern era, right before the Clean Air Act, somehow we discovered, much as China is discovering now, that if pollution is not actionable, namely anybody can dump any crap on anyone else's land provided they pulverize it finely enough into dust, well, what you're going to get is vast pollution. And I remember seeing a cartoon in one of the, I think it was New York Magazine or one of those, and there was a mother and a daughter eating lunch in an outdoor restaurant, and you'd think the mother would say to the daughter, hurry up, dear, eat your soup before it gets cold. Instead, she said, hurry up and eat your soup before it gets dirty. Well, so we now had to have a Clean Air Act because obviously you had market failure. And I'm being sarcastic here, there was no market failure. It was a government failure to uphold private property rights. Government seized the monopoly of courts, and it said, you know, we'll protect private property rights. And they did the very opposite, and then we inherited a whirlwind.
Well, Walter, let me raise an objection that I think a lot of people might have. They might say, this is a good story Walter Block is telling us, and yes, of course it would be nice to hold polluters strictly liable in this way, but maybe the regulatory approach of government is superior after all, because suppose some concern somewhere is polluting my water or polluting my air, and it's giving my kids cancer, and I'm waiting, you know, 2 years to get into the government's crummy courts to go have them hear my claim. You know, meanwhile, we're all dead. I mean, it seems like a very slow approach, whereas a regulatory approach would be, look, we're going to stop you from emitting X amount of pollution to start with. It's not ideal, but it's more or less given us a livable situation in the U.S. How would you answer that?
Well, it's a very strange objection. Not unusual, but strange, illogical in the sense that it assumes one branch of government will be super uber efficient and another branch of government will not be efficient at all. And to me, all government is inefficient, but why we should single out branches and say that the courts will be very inefficient, whereas the regulatory bureaus will be efficient. I don't know. I just don't see it. Another objection along these lines is, look, you can't sue everybody. Right now, I don't know how many people own cars, and assuming that there were no catalytic converter and EPA regulations, what are you going to do, start suing 100 million automobile owners? Murray's answer to that is, look, yes, that would be very inefficient because each automobile contributes very, very little pollution unless it's a real, smoky car. So, each one could say, look, I'm hiding under de minimis. So Murray's answer is, look, we have to privatize the highways, which is a whole other subject that I got from Murray. I wrote a book on that as well. And now what you do is you don't sue each individual car owner, of which there are millions, but rather you sue each highway owner or street owner, of which there would be, hundreds of thousands in the whole country. And it would be much more malleable and much more effective, much more efficient that way. In effect, you're suing each car owner for, being a body house. Or like if there was a nightclub making a lot of noise, any one person probably isn't making all that much noise. But if you get 300-400 people in a nightclub, together they make a terrific racket. So you wouldn't sue each individual partygoer for yelling or making noise. You would sue the nightclub or the place that's emanating the noise or from which the noise is emanating. So it would be similar. You don't sue each car owner. What you do is you sue the highway owner or the street owner, and that makes it much more effective.
Let me now raise the point of view of the free market environmentalist, we might say. I learned this from Martin Feldstein years ago as a Harvard freshman, actually. And the idea was this, that yes, we understand that in the old days we had this stupid top-down approach to pollution abatement. We would just say, all right, everybody, cut 30% of your pollution across the board. And then we realized that it was a heck of a lot more expensive for some firms to cut 30% than it was for others, for where it would be relatively easy for them to cut 30%. So maybe we could try to say instead, well, here's the overall amount of pollution abatement we want, but how it actually gets abated, which firm does more pollution abatement than any other firm, that doesn't really matter to us so much. So we'll introduce tradable pollution rights so that the firms that can abate pollution very inexpensively can just do so, and they can sell their pollution rights and earn money. They won't need to use those pollution rights because they're not going to pollute. They'll just spend a little money, get rid of their pollution, and they can just sell their pollution rights to a company that it would cost them a fortune to abate pollution, but it would be a lot cheaper for them just to buy the pollution rights. And this way we get the same amount of overall pollution reduction, but at a much lower cost to society. What's the matter with that from Walter Block's point of view?
Well, at the beginning of the show, you did say that me and Murray and the people associated with the Mises Institute and people like that, weirdos, are very radical on the free market environmentalism. Well, there are the Chicago types, people who are free market environmentalists, sort of, or semi-free market environmentalists. I'm thinking of this group called PERC, Political Economic Resource Center, located in Montana. And there are other groups like that inside the Beltway that favor these sorts of things. It would be very similar to ITQs for fish, international tradable quotas on fish instead of private property rights in fish. It would be very similar to Milton Friedman's view on, educational vouchers, where you buy and sell vouchers. By the way, I think the technical term is not tradable pollution permits, but rather tradable emission rights, but I'm not sure. I think both terms are in vogue. The problem here, talk about buying and selling pollution rights. Well, how about buying and selling rape rights? Look, we don't want rape. Rape is a bad thing. And, maybe one rapist can reduce his rape rate at a much more efficient rate than other rapists can reduce their rape rate. I hope you get what I'm trying to say here. I don't want the New York Times on here and saying
I get what you're trying to say, yes.
I can just see the New York Times saying, well, Block comes out in favor of rape and wants rapists to trade rape rights. No. This is a
Yeah, just for the record, let's just clarify, right. Walter's right. against rape.
Yes.
In case any blockhead with an IQ of 50 is listening.
Yes, I oppose rape. Rape is a bad thing. It violates the tradable emissions rights. It violates the non-aggression principle. What I'm trying to do is make a reductio ad absurdum, or I'm trying to label this as is. In other words, if you regard pollution as a property right, well, then how can you have a right to violate rights? It's sort of a bit of a contradiction. On the other hand, I have to admit that the Chicagoans have something to be said for them. In some sense, ITQs are better than the tragedy of the commons. And in some sense, Milton Friedman's, voucher system is more efficient than central planning. It's sort of like market socialism, the socialism of Tito in Hungary. It had certain advantages and other disadvantages. I on net balance, come out against ITQs. I come out against Friedman's schemes. I come out against all these Chicago-type schemes where you have semi-demi private property, or you have a market-based. That's it. They call it market-based. Well, I'm against market-based. I'm in favor of markets. And this is sort of the inside of the Beltway, people. But I have to admit that if you have to reduce pollution, let's say there are three polluters, and each of them are polluting 50 units of pollution per time period, and somehow we've decided that the maximum we can stand is 100 pollution, well, one way to do is say, okay, each of you guys has to reduce from 50 to 33, and that way we'll go from 150 to 100. On the other hand, why not allow one of them to reduce pollution, not at all, maybe even increase it, and the other two to decrease it a lot so that together they come down to 100? But this is not really free enterprise. This is market socialism. This is Chicago-type free enterprise, or inside the Beltway-type free enterprise. It has certain advantages and disadvantages compared to the tragedy of the commons, or to having no law against pollution at all. On the other hand, it's hardly exactly what you want to write home about. It's not really the essence of free enterprise. And the problem is so tragic because, one, the full free enterprise system is more efficient than the quasi-market system, and two, it sends the wrong message that somehow there is market failure and the government has to come in and fix it up, and the way they're going to fix it up is to be quasi-market-oriented, and then these people say, well, we're really free enterprise. They're not really free enterprise. They're muffling the free enterprise trumpet. The free enterprise trumpet is the Rothbardian trumpet of, pure private property rights.
Walter, let's switch to species extinction and endangered species. Because here, I think it's easy for a person of goodwill, anyway, to understand the logic of our position, that you tend to be better stewards when you have property rights and you can you think about the long-term capital value of your asset. You don't just think about consuming it in the immediate run for the income it gives you. I think people can sort of get that. In the case of the U.S. government, I have in my book Rollback an interesting statistic. The net recovery rate out of over 1,300 listed species on the endangered species list is six, not 600. Six is how many, through all their spying and police work and hangmen to try to save the endangered species, they've got six. And the incentive that it gives people is to kill endangered species they find on their property, because, of course, if there's an endangered species, a member of an endangered species found on your property, they basically take over your property. It becomes a protected habitat. So, of course, if I find the spotted owl or whatever, I have the incentive to shoot him in the head instead of to preserve him. So how, then, could the marketplace, could the private property order be brought to bear to try to solve this problem?
Oh, yes. This is a very good example to show the virtues government ownership, nor of non-ownership, we have the tragedy of the commons, and nor of quasi-markets, but of pure markets. There is this woman, Eleanor Ostrom, who has won the Nobel Prize recently, and she attacked Bob Smith, Robert J. Smith, who was a devotee, a lieutenant of Murray Rothbard's in the old days. He was part of the living room crowd. And Bob Smith made the rational point of the tragedy of the commons. when you own stuff in common, you tend not to take as good care of it as when you own it individually. If you have a can of soda, and I slip in the straw a monitoring device that shows how fast you sip at your soda. Well, if you own it, you'll sip it whenever you feel the urge, whenever you feel a little thirsty. But you're not going to rush to drink it up before I get it, because I can't get it because you own it. Whereas if instead we had two cans of soda and now we had two straws in there, a bigger can, we would each say, hey, maybe I better slurp it up before that greedy block does. And I'll say, evil Woods is going to slurp up my soda. And if you have hundreds of people doing that, then you're going to dissipate the resource very quickly. So there is such a thing as a tragedy of the commons. And unfortunately, Eleanor Ostrom got a Nobel Prize by attacking the very concept, which is ridiculous. Take the elephant. Right now, the elephant in Africa is endangered in many countries, and what is the response of the people in charge? It's to get ivory tusks and to burn them, and to have this thing called CITES, Convention on International Trade in Extinct Species. And what they do is they want to stop trade, and they want to focus attention on the problem by burning very precious ivory, which is very, very precious. See, right now, the problem with the elephants is that they're not owned. They're not fully owned. And when they're not fully owned, nobody's going to be protecting them, and the poachers go out there and just kill them to get the ivory, and they don't care whether it's a young pregnant elephant or an old elephant. They just grab the tusks and run. So, of course, the elephant species are going to be going extinct. On the other hand, if we privatize them, think of a big barnyard with electric fences and maybe a big barnyard, not just a couple of acres, but a couple of square miles, because elephants need space to roam around in. But they're very, people think that the reason they're endangered is because they're valuable. No, the reason they're endangered is because they're not owned. Horses and cows are pretty valuable. Certain dogs are valuable. Some dogs very exquisite breeds are, tens of thousands of dollars per dog. No, the reason that animals are going, the elephant and the rhino are going extinct is not because they're valuable. Their value is the main reason why we'll keep them alive if we can only own them. The example I'm fond of using is the cow and the buffalo. The cow and the buffalo are about the same size. They're both about the same weight. They both smell alike, as far as I know. I've never really been that close. And isn't it amazing that the buffalo almost went extinct, whereas the cow never came within a million miles of extinction? And you have these horrible movies, Dancing with Wolves, which give the left-wing view that the reason for extinction of the buffalo is, white men are evil and capitalism is evil and greed is evil. No, the reason is that people own cows individually, and if you slaughtered a cow, that was a very, very expensive operation for you because you wouldn't have a cow tomorrow. So the cost to you of losing a cow today is you don't have the cow tomorrow, whereas the buffalo, if you shoot it, you're not going to have that buffalo anyway. So the cost is virtually nothing, just the cost of the bullet. So the buffalo were being slaughtered with impunity, and people were not allowed to own buffalo for many years. Nowadays, happily, in the United States, people are allowed to own buffalo, and there's no problem. And it's the same thing with the crocodile and fish and just about anything, any animal. Well, as far as I'm concerned, the elephant is just a buffalo with big, funny nose and big, funny ears. And what saved the buffalo can save the elephant and the rhino and other valuable creatures. Just allow people to own them privately, and then they will have very, very strong incentives. Was there to protect them? Look, was there ever cattle rustling? Yeah, there was cattle rustling, but 1 or 2% compared to buffalo. Buffalo were just being shot left and right. So allow people to own buffalo. They'll take care of them. They'll have barnyards. They'll not only be able to take advantage of the tusks, the ivory. They'll also be able to take advantage of the skin, of the meat. And will you be allowed to kill a buffalo? Sure. An elephant on the property ownership? Sure. If I owned a son and you wanted to be a safari hunter and you shot an old male elephant, I might charge you $20,000-$30,000 or whatever it is. You want to shoot a young female elephant? Okay, sure. But now it's going to cost you $3 million or you know, some much, much higher figure because female, young females are the limit on the biology. So if we had full private ownership, no quasi, demi, semi, market-based anything, just private ownership, elephants and rhinos, just the way we treat cows and horses and dogs and cats, then the whole problem would go away.
You know, there's so many other environmental issues we could hit on, and I think this will have to be the last one, unfortunately, but it's all been good information. I do want to ask one last thing on this, though, which is, suppose we're talking to a radical environmentalist. I'm not talking about the general, you know, sort of the soccer mom who, in the abstract, would like to see the environment cared for, would like to see species protected. But I'm talking about, you know what I mean, like the absolutely radical, all life is equal, and if anything, human life is somewhat less so because humans are so bad and wicked and they want to kill all the species. Suppose we're dealing with somebody like that. I'm not sure libertarianism, although I do think it can appeal to basically everybody, I'm not sure it can appeal to them because their view would be, I shouldn't have to buy up the different species. They have an inherent value whether or not they have immediate use for human beings. And so there'll be species that we have no immediate utilitarian use for, and yet I still don't want to see them die out, and I don't want to have to start a nature conservatory every single time there's an endangered species. I just demand that everybody curtail his activities in the face of these species. I mean, how is there any way that you can reach somebody like that?
Well, you know, there's a joke. An economist was asked, how is your wife? And his answer was, compared to what? It's supposed to be a funny joke.
Yeah, but no, I've heard it too many times, though, Walter.
Okay. You're a lousy audience, Tom. The question is, we're going to have a tough row to hoe to convert this guy, but compared to what? And I think the message we can give to the Gaia is, the Gaia, Earth Mother, you know, even when you plow, you're invading the Earth Mother, you're using violence against her, is, look, we'll give you a better deal than those guys. Those guys, the animals are going to go extinct. At least us, they won't go extinct. So it's true you're not going to get the whole loaf with us, but you'll get part of the loaf, you'll get something. You know, another problem with the Gaia is, if they believe that all animals have rights, well, suppose a lion kills an antelope. Should we consider the lion guilty of murder? It would appear that we would have to, based on their own position. So another attack at them, or another way to deal with them, is to try to show that they're illogical, because none of them believe that, you know, lions are guilty of murder, and yet if they believe that lions have as much rights as human beings, you know, then the lion should be accused of murder. And then there's also the reductio ad absurdum. Okay, look, you are a Gaiaist, I see you have a leather belt there, you know, take that leather belt off. You're not a vegetarian? Well, you have to be a vegetarian. But even vegetarians are not good, because what they've done is they put EEGs into plants. And when you pull a plant out of the earth, it gives sort of like a shriek. And if the, the Gaiaists are consistent with their principles, they would have to say, well, you know, we can't eat plants either.
Well, listen, Walter, I really appreciate this conversation. Of course, everybody should read that Rothbard article that you mentioned at the start, but there's a lot of work that can still be done on this subject. A lot of times we get young scholars and they say, what can I work on? Well, wouldn't you agree there's plenty of stuff to do on the environment?
Oh, yes. Magnificent. It's the overlap of law and biology and libertarian theory. It's not really Austrian economics, but what the heck? No. For young scholars, there's any number of essays and PhD theses that can be written. And as long as you have Rothbard in mind, you will at least know what the right view is, the correct view. And don't be misled by the Chicagoans, free market imposters.
Good advice, Walter. Thanks again for being here. Always appreciated.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. If you enjoyed this program, one way to help me out is to subscribe. Don't just listen to a fugitive episode here and there. Who knows what you may be missing? Check out the links for iTunes and Stitcher at TomWoodsRadio.com. That's our show site, TomWoodsRadio.com. And you can also help me pay the bills associated with this podcast at no cost to yourself by remembering us when you're about to make an Amazon purchase. Just do so through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. Tomorrow, it's Chase Madar joining me. He's a guy on the left. He's written a book on the Bradley Manning issue. We're going to talk Bradley Manning and foreign policy and related matters. That should be a fun conversation tomorrow. And then later this week, it's Joel Salatin. You're not going to want to miss that. See you later. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.